This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Colin Thubrun's new travel book, In Siberia, begins with this haunting description. The ice fields are crossed forever by a man in chains. In the farther distance, perhaps, a reindeer drifts, or a hunter makes a shadow on the snow. But that is all. Siberia. It fills 1/12 of the landmass of the whole earth, yet this is all it leaves for certain in the mind. A bleak beauty and an indelible fear. Thubrun covered nearly 15,000 miles of this vast land, traveling by train, boat, car, and foot from Mongolia to the Arctic Circle, from the Ural Mountains north of Kazakhstan as far as China's easternmost border. In Siberia is Thubrun's third book in a series of Russian travelogues. It follows Where Nights Are Longest, about his travels in western Russia during the end of the Brezhnev era, and The Lost Heart of Asia, about a trip to the Muslim republics of Central Asia after the collapse of the Soviet Empire. He says he wrote about Siberia against his will. It was simply too imposing, both historically and physically, to ignore. In the West, Siberia is synonymous with exile and brutality. It's the land of the Gulag, the network of prison and death camps under Stalin. I asked Thubrun what Siberia means to Russians.
Since Tsarist times, since the 17th century virtually, it's been a place where Western Russia has expelled its unwanted elements, whether they're criminal, dissident, whatever. So the Russians are, you know, completely used to it as being synonymous with fear. But there's also been this other strange countervailing feeling about Russia, that it was a land of Siberia, that it was a land of innocence in some way. It was a land where traditionally peasants went who were rather more enterprising than those who stayed back in Western Russia after the abolition of serfdom, and find a flood of fairly poor peasantry going out who had some sort of initiative, could carve out lands as much as they wanted from crown land, basically, could escape authority, whether it was aristocratic, czarist authority or ecclesiastical authority. A land, in other words, Siberia, that was suggested a greater freedom. And so it was also, oddly enough, a land that they thought of as innocent, a place where a Siberia really that was uncontaminated by the West, whereas Western Russia, they've always felt as or many Russians have felt it was corrupted by the West. Siberia was a sort of essential Russia, or a place where Russia would like to think itself was.
So it was Russia's wild, wild West.
Exactly.
Right? In this case, Russia's wild east. Right.
Yes, the sort of place of enterprise. But also this idea that it was purity. Peasants even located their Belovodya here, as they called it, their paradise, literally.
One of your first stops was the site where the last Tsar, Nicholas, and his family were assassinated, were executed. What kind of memorial exists at the site?
There was nothing when I came there except a small shrine on one side. The place had been bulldozed over in the Brezhnev period in the 1970s when, oddly enough, Boris Yeltsin was the local Communist Party chief who had ordered it. He later regretted it. And so the merchant's house where the family had been assassinated was bulldozed away, and there was just this level stretch of tarmac. But in the back, there was the garden where the Tsar and his daughters had walked in their last days. And I wandered around there. It was sort of great, a tangled wilderness now. And typically Russia, found an ex-convict living there on a rubbish dump who was just a sort of vagrant. And he would steal the flowers which people left at the memorial and resell them the next day. There weren't many actually visiting the memorial. It was interesting, just a few, many of them very religious.
Why did you go?
I went, I think, because, well, Yekaterinburg, this place, is the, I suppose it's the westernmost part, or the westernmost city of Siberia. I went because places like that give you an indication of what people are feeling about their political situation, I think. And often I pick places to go because they speak for the present. Obviously, Yekaterinburg appears to belong to the past. What people associate it with is the death of the Tsar and his family. But by going there now, you see in a way how modern Russians feel about their Tsarist past, whether they revere it, whether they ignore it, whether they detest it, simply by how people are behaving at that site. And on the whole, I have to say, I found that they were not very interested. There was a tiny trickle of pilgrims, some of them eccentric. And it seemed to me, talking to Russians later, that the Tsars meant rather little.
Early on in your trip, you visited Vorkuta, and that was the town near the coal mines that became the death camps for thousands. What's left of the camps?
Very little now. Even many of the mines are closed down. But beside each mine, you would find, if you looked, many graves of the miners simply left without names on them, just numbers lying in the undergrowth. And you would find the remains of these enormous long barracks where the miners were housed, with usually just a stove to keep them warm. And those were made of wood and have sort of crashed into the earth. And you see them sort of scattered about. And some tangles of barbed wire here and there, a fallen watchtower of a familiar kind. But really almost nothing else. Here and there, they've been preserved and people are actually living in them. In one or two cases, even people who are the descendants of those who worked there, or those who worked there themselves, even in one or two cases, because they had nowhere else to go. And when they were liberated, so-called, they were still stuck there.
Do they talk of their experience?
They do, many reluctantly. It's not anything that they usually, I found, wanted to share, and there was a sort of sickening of it. But it was always very interesting when somebody was prepared to talk, because their attitude was so unfamiliar, I think, to us in the West. And we have all been brought up to believe that the way to deal with something like with the death camps is to remember. I mean, this is the Jewish Western way, and we have to remember, otherwise we repeat the mistake. The Russians don't appear to feel that, not in their bones. They almost seem to accept it in a way that I found very hard to deal with when I was talking to them. I wanted them to be angry. I wanted them to locate blame, and they wouldn't. They seemed to more or less treat it as if suffering was natural. It came out of the sky, and you would try to get them to blame Stalin, and they wouldn't. One old woman I remember in particular, who had been 12 years in the labor camps, said, I'm bitter for all my life's waste, she said. And I said, bitter for what exactly? And who was she angry with? And she said, I'm bitter with the present regime, is what she was basically saying. Bitter with the post-Gorbachev era, because everything that I labored for in the camps, building roads in the camps, has gone to ruin. You know, it's all falling to bits in this age where the Soviet Union's gone. In other words, she was lamenting the purposelessness of it, not inhumanity, but sheer purposelessness of it. She was saying that she had labored for those 12 years for the Soviet Union, for Stalin, he who had actually been responsible for her imprisonment. And she wasn't going to blame them. She was going to blame the modern age for having destroyed what she, in her slavery, had attempted to build up.
Did you find many people nostalgic then for the communist regime?
Yes. Maybe less for communism than for Stalin. I think not for communism per se, and there are those, of course, but in general they have a nostalgia for power. The Russians always seem ready to surrender freedom in exchange for a feeling of being protected. This is historical, not just from the communist period. They seem to be almost, as one Russian told me, you know, kissing the axe that beheads them, in love with suffering. That perhaps is to take it a bit far, but they seem always to be nostalgic now, not always, but many, nostalgic for Stalin, which means, I think, not for communism, but for the feeling of being protected. For stable prices, for assured jobs, assured accommodation, and for the prestige of being, again, part of a great empire. They miss that.
I'm talking with Colin Thubrun. He's a travel writer, also a novelist. He's written about his travels in the Middle East and China. His new book, In Siberia, is the last in a trilogy about the Russian lands. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Colin Thubrun. His new book is In Siberia. many of the indigenous tribes in Siberia that you were interested in finding more about were wiped out by communism. You went to the far north, an Arctic remote fishing village, and help me out here. The name is Potalova?
Potalova, yes.
Potalova. Yes. There are still some native peoples of the Ensi tribe there. What was that town like?
That town was terrible. I had hoped that the further I went from the main Russian industrial centers, say in Siberia, the better things might be. But in fact, they seemed to be worse. That town was a little town of reindeer herders once and of fishermen. But the reindeer pastures had been so much despoiled by fallout, by acid rain from the nickel processing factories 100 miles to the north, that the reindeer were fading away. And there were various other things, like oil pipelines, which deflected wild reindeer even from the areas, which used to be a source of for hunters. And the population was really reduced to having to fish on the Yenisei River, which they were doing, but it wasn't enough really to keep them going. It was a village of about 500, half of them Russian, I suppose, and half of them Ensi, who were kind of Turkic people. They were really drinking themselves to death, and has to say the life expectation had gone down to about 45. Many of them died violent deaths, and the whole sort of morale of the place had disintegrated. Before 1989, the Russians had sent to these isolated Arctic communities consumer goods at a reasonable price, and food products. That system disappeared in the last of the Gorbachev years, and now they're reliant on commercial enterprises for doing the same thing, and it's not really happening, and they can hardly keep themselves alive.
What kind of goods are there on the store shelves?
Well, precious little. About once a month, a boat would come down the Yenisei, open up a hatch, and dispense cheap vodka above all, which is one thing that was still cheap that the fishermen could afford. Otherwise, they would simply get a few, you know, canned goods of some sort of meat, maybe, and a few sort of rudimentary vegetables. And that was about it. There was a lot of malnutrition, undoubtedly, and high blood pressure, various diseases which those extreme temperatures invite. And even while I was there, a young man had simply dropped dead by his boat and was being buried on the hill opposite.
Under such extreme conditions, is there any sense of attachment to their heritage or a spiritual center to the people?
I had hoped to find among the Turkic Ensi, who were shamanists originally, were animists, that there would be traces of a culture to which they might be clinging or going back. There were terribly few. I hunted for them in vain, and I'd done a bit of research back in libraries in the West about the old Ensi gods and beliefs. And when I tried to talk to them about it, I found I knew more than they did in some instances. They'd forgotten the names of their legendary heroes and their gods. And they had also lost the Christianity that they'd inherited in the Tsarist period, and now they'd lost the communism that had been given them in the 20th century. And so they'd been sort of released into a no man's land. The only place that I found some sort of pagan vestige was in the cemetery, which is so often the kind of repository of a conservative tradition, and they had kept a few customs there. I remember the last day I was in that village, just walking up the hillside in the cemetery, and suddenly, beyond the graves which had Christian crosses on them or communist stars, there were these other ones which had reindeer horns on them, banked up, and reindeer skulls were hanging in the trees. And on every grave, there was a bowl or a kettle which had been ritually gouged out so that it was destroyed. Somebody had made a hole in it and turned upside down. When I left, I asked an old herdsman about this, and he said, well, you see, the afterlife is the opposite of this one. Things which are the right way up over here are upside down over there. Things that are upside down here are the right way up over there. Everything is the opposite. And so these gifts on the graves have to be that way up. Otherwise, the dead will not find them, he said. And so he conceived that the afterlife, being the opposite of this one, was a paradise.
Colin Thubron is my guest. He's a travel writer. He's written a trilogy of books about Russian lands. His new book is In Siberia. Now, Siberia was off limits for so many years until, I think, it was in 1993?
Yes, 92, 93.
So in preparing for your trip, did you even have guidebooks?
Yes, there were a few guidebooks that had visited towns, usually. But they had, you know, visited them perhaps a year or two before I had. If I wanted to see somewhere that had been, say, off limits, which meant almost everywhere before 1991, and that somewhere was fairly small, then I just had to take a risk on what it was like. You know, I didn't know.
Hitch a ride?
Yes. Go on a local bus, take a boat. If we were going up the Yenisei, I went up the Yenisei to the Arctic Circle. Usually there was something there. The Russians are great ones for hitchhiking. And if you were standing by the side of the road, somebody, you would pay them. It was almost a sort of accepted system that you would give them a little bit of money anyway towards their petrol expenses, say. And so it was that was easy, provided there was traffic on the road. There was usually some sort of lorry traffic, trucks.
There must have been times when you didn't get a ride for hours, when you were out on the road in the cold. How do you cope with that? You just know something will come along?
Patience, I suppose, and maybe a certain perhaps arrogant self-confidence. I've always felt that I was going to be all right in these countries. The Russians in general, particularly out in the villages and so on, are basically kindly. I didn't feel threatened on the whole, and I never really got a sense that I was badly in danger. You just need to wait, honestly, and to let your sense of time alter. You move out of Western time and into Russian time, and if you have to wait a couple of days for a lorry to get the petrol that you need to get you to a certain place, then you wait. And it seems to be part of the personality of the country and the way of journeying. So you feel in a sense that it's not wasted.
Now, when you traveled before in the Soviet Union, that was the end of the Brezhnev era, were you followed constantly by the KGB?
Not constantly, towards the end of my time there. For about, I think, 3 weeks, I was followed by the KGB. It was very obvious they were following me.
Oh, they were very subtle?
They were not terribly subtle. They were terribly well-trained, in a way. They all did exactly the same thing. They were always, you know, two or three trucks behind you on the road. I was driving. And it's very hard, I think, to be followed if you are driving. You just have to go, you know, three times round a roundabout and see who does the same thing. And I think what happened, at least I guessed what happened with the KGB that were following me, they're terrified of losing you. If they have to report back to their bosses that they've lost you, that's the worst. And they would much rather risk that you know you're being followed than that they should actually lose you. So they were pretty, it was pretty obvious when you were being followed.
Well, did they know you were a writer? And did they ever get their hands on your notes or anything that you considered important?
I don't know what they knew. I rather think they didn't know anything much, because my first many weeks in Russia, I was not followed, I'm sure, because I was going into camps. I started out in the summer there, and the camps are run by students on a temporary basis. I expect they thought that, you know, Western governments could afford to send their spies to smart hotels, and they didn't seem to have regulated the camps. And for a long time, I think, they didn't seem to be chasing me much. But the moment the camps filled it up and I had to go into large hotels, they traced me and started following me. Every large hotel in Russia in those days had a KGB unit, probably still does. And it was then that they started to follow me. I was prepared when I got to the border, and I drove to a place with the sinister name of Chop on the Hungarian border, that I would be done over quite badly, and indeed they did. They stripped me, body searched me, developed the film in my camera, took bits of my car to bits. They were fairly sure that I had been up to something. I hadn't really. I'd been seeing dissidents, but I hadn't got any information with me, any literature, nothing. And eventually they were stuck with my notes. They had this diary, really. I had made the notes for my forthcoming book into a diary. And they couldn't read it because my writing's illegible even to my friends. It's very small and horrible. And so I was finally summoned down to the bowels of this customs house where a uniformed KGB officer was looking through my diary. And he said, "Have you developed this writing specially?" he said. I said, "No." And then he made me read out bits in front of him for about half an hour. He noted one or two little headings there, and he saw Odessa. So he pointed and said, "Odessa, read out that." So I read out, of course. He couldn't read what I'd written, so I read out how the sun was sparkling on the waves in Odessa and the birds were singing in the trees and so on. And after about half an hour, he was a real Russian. He said, "This is very poetic," he said. "You could publish this." I felt a little guilty then.
That's not a very brutal editor.
No, it was not.
Colin Thubron, thank you for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Colin Thubron's new book is In Siberia. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on the mainstreaming of 70s psychobabble. This is Fresh Air.